You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust. And this evening's program is the first of two that will focus on John Cage's time at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, which formally began with the academic year 1960-61, when Cage served as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Studies. During this year, he prepared several scores for publication and also assembled writings to be included in his first collection, Silence, which would be his first work published by Wesleyan University Press on October 26, 1961. This would be followed over the years by A Year from Monday in 1967, M, Writings 67 to 72 in 1973, Empty Words, Writings 73 to 78, published in 1979, and X, Writings 79 to 82, published in 1983. After Cage's death in 1992, Wesleyan University Press would also publish his Anarchy in 2001 and the 50th anniversary edition of Silence in 2013, with a foreword by Kyle Gann, as well as Joan Retallack's beautiful Music Cage, Cage Muses on Words, Art, and Music in 1996, and The Selected Letters of John Cage, edited by me and published in 2016, out this year in paperback, also with a foreword by Kyle Gann. Cage spent two semesters at Wesleyan in 1960-61 and returned for one more in 1969. But he preceded both by two visits with David Tudor, the first in 1955 and the second in early 1960, prior to the commencement of his first appointment. In their 1955 program, Cage gave a brief lecture about the impact of tape on music composition, then performed with Tudor in a program that included Stockhausen's Klavierstücke 1 through 8 and Cage's own 34 minutes, 46.776 seconds for two pianos from 1954, as well as other works, likely including music for piano. In their 1960 program, given at the Honors College, they performed solo for piano from Concert for Piano and Orchestra from 1957-58, with Fontana Mix, WBAI from 1960, and Music Walk from 1958. Tudor also gave the first performance of music for amplified toy pianos from 1960 and performed Winter Music from 1957. He also played Christian Wolff's Four Piano with Preparations from 1957 and Four Pianist from 1959. While at Wesleyan, Cage gave humanities classes in experimental music and also presented various of his own works, including Lecture on Nothing at the John Wesley Club. One of my very favorite of his talks, delivered in 1960 as an address to the gentlemen of the Wesleyan Glee Club, remains unpublished outside of a simple reproduction in transcription on Kuhn's blog published in 2017, available at johncage.org, which I titled John Cage on Gluttony, Saints, Table Manners, Fasting, and Wild Edibles. It's held in manuscript among Cage's papers within the special archives of Wesleyan University's library. I'm going to read this to you this evening and hope very much that you find it as delightful as I do. Cage made steadfast friends at Wesleyan, including faculty composers Alvin Lussier and Neely Bruce. Sadly, Lussier died earlier this year, but Neely is still going strong, prolific as ever as a composer and nearing his 50th year of teaching at the university. We'll be doing a program together for All Things Cage just as soon as we can get our lives and schedules to coincide, perhaps as early as next week. And as we'll hear in this address this evening, Cage was especially fond of Richard K. Winslow, familiarly known as Dick, who graduated from Wesleyan in 1940, joined the faculty in 1949, and who would spend the next 35 years of his life at the university, giving it the incredible scope and shape for which it is now well known. Significantly, given tonight's program, Winslow was for a time director of the Wesleyan Glee Club. Although Cage was never a regular faculty member at Wesleyan, Winslow would later speak of him as among his most intellectually and musically influential colleagues. A particularly beautiful piece about Winslow's life and colleagues is available online in an article by Peter Frenzel, a piece entitled Wesleyan's Man of Musics, which appeared in the Wesleyan University Wash Center for Retired Faculty Newsletter, Spring 2012, Volume 3, Number 2. Also available online is a marvelous piece entitled, What Was the Wesleyan Glee Club? A Primer. Now on to John Cage's 1960 Address to the Gentlemen of the Wesleyan Glee Club. Come back next week for part two of John Cage's time at Wesleyan University. Though I am honored to have been asked to speak to you, I am speechless with amazement. That a group of seemingly still growing young men should have resolved to eat dinner only once a year fills me with awe. I like to think that matters spiritual and physical are so closely united that they cannot be split apart. But your example gives me pause. Since we at the Center for Advanced Studies not only eat dinner 365 times a year, but indulge also in breakfast and lunch each day, we are, so to say, 1,094 times as dependent on food as you are. This great difference in food consumption makes me suspect that you pick up a little food here and there in the course of a year when no one is looking. Or should I say when you yourselves are not singing. I have therefore telephoned extension 235, spoken to Mrs. Jessie M. Doherty, and found out that this is indeed your only meal this year, that you have no annual luncheon, no annual breakfast, just this one annual dinner. That you dignify it by calling it a banquet is understandable, and that you have eaten in quantity, unstintingly, is also understandable. I have unlimited admiration for your director, Richard K. Winslow. I asked him the other evening whether it was indeed true that food held little attraction for him. He paused and then said, it was, that is, food doesn't. Whether your discipline of not eating comes from him to you, indicating his extraordinary powers of direction, or whether your continence has reached from you to him, indicating the infectious quality of your devotion, is a question that defies my powers of thought. Nevertheless, in keeping with the Wesleyan ideal of the teacher-scholar, and not wishing to teach you my bad gluttonous habits, I place before you what I can find in a spirit of scholarship off the top of my head in the way of historical instance that bears a small relationship to your wondrous accomplishment, though these instances may not be said to be commensurate. I have heard tell of the Incas of Peru who chewed coca leaves in order to avoid eating and yet continue their life of toil, carrying stones from hither to yon. It is not known whether or not they sang while working and whether if they did sing, they did so in a spirit of glee. I am certain though that, unlike the Incas, you are not addicted to dope or manual labor. And were there not saints who sat on poles for months without eating? What were their names? Sri Ramakrishna, an adjudicated 19th century incarnation of God, did indeed stand on one foot for several months in a state of samadhi, that is to say, spiritual ecstasy. However, one of his disciples from day to day inserted food in his mouth. The mere mention of his name in the present context is out of place. However, he had a great interest in singing, and when he was asked by one of his devotees, who was a musician, whether or not he, the devotee, should give up music and devote himself to the spiritual life, Sri Ramakrishna replied, "By no means. Remain a musician. Music is a means of rapid transportation to life everlasting." This subject of transportation reminds me of another saint, a Tibetan one, Milarepa, who did not do what you do, that is, eat only one meal a day, but who remarkably ate only thistles. This had the effect of his transporting himself through the air in the form of a thistle. He was also able to appear in several different places at the same time. Perhaps you're not eating will, or has already given you the power of appearing nowhere. I owe this supposition to Norman O. Brown, who had the kindness to listen to the first draft of this speech. Before leaving the subject of Milarepa, let me say that he wrote songs, but I forget whether or not he sang them himself. He died, as a matter of fact, from eating. On three occasions, he was offered poisoned food by one of the wives of another saint, who was so jealous of Milarepa's spiritual position in Tibet that he desired his death. He promised this wife that if she succeeded in getting Milarepa to eat the poisoned food, that he would make her number one among his concubines. Mind you, Milarepa, through having eaten for years nothing but thistles, was clairvoyant. He knew perfectly well that the food was poisoned. But he also knew clairvoyantly that the lady really wanted him to eat it. Therefore, taking pity on her, the third time she offered it to him, he took it, ate it, but he himself appointed the hour of his death. My colleague in the center, Marsden Bates, tells me that there are two volumes of documentation on a forced fasting that took place during the Second World War in a camp of conscientious objectors. It appears that the dreams of these men lost all suggestions of the erotic life and became completely devoted to such things as meat and potatoes. I cannot refrain from wondering what the nature of your dreams are, you of the Wesleyan Glee Club. Perhaps after singing all day, you pass a peaceful night undisturbed by dreams, secure in your knowledge of the inevitability of this annual supper for which you have spent an entire year singing. Fully aware that as a scholar I cut a poor figure, I have asked Reginald Aragon, who spoke last fall at the convocation in honor of scholarship, to give me some story that would be appropriate for you to hear after your single dinner of this academic year. He communicated the following delicious text. Picture to yourselves four scholars and scientists, an anthropologist of Russian ancestry, the host, a sociologist, the guest of honor, a psychologist, and a historian, all faculty colleagues sitting down to a rich Russian midnight repast in honor of the approaching departure of the sociologist from the faculty and community, a separation to be begun by his withdrawal to a theosophical retreat on Orcas Island. For he was a Dutchman who was not only infected by theosophy, but seriously so. Unhappily, he was even then fasting to give him the spiritual state necessary for profiting from the retreat. The fast permitted him only water. Even in the face of this spread of meats, cheeses and cakes, anchovies and caviar, though he confided to us that his wife, who was not present, could have taken orange juice. Such laxity had to be granted to the woman, who is the weaker vessel. the psychologist, a gross, hardy elephant of a man, not to be outdone in physical endurance or spiritual self-denial by a sociologist, then recalled that he had fasted once, though he had no intention of fasting now. Indeed, he remembered even that the fast was last summer, that it was to cut down his weight, that it went on for weeks, that he did not need even water, but got stronger every day. He was in a forest of the state of Washington, and like Paul Bunyan, he cut down trees daily. The sociologist's interest and admiration increased minute by minute as the psychologist added detail after detail to the account of this triumphant fast. But then asked the theosophist, why did you stop? Because it was near the 4th of July and the end of the strawberry season, and he succumbed to temptation with the thought that in 2 days, the luscious red fresh fruit would be gone irretrievably for a year. So it was in the days before frozen foods, and so the great experiment was abandoned. Not, however, was that of the socio-theosophist as he sat in front of the Russian meal and watched the anthropologist, the psychologist, and the historian eat into the night. He made only one minor concession of no apparent importance, but one that should be a warning to all fasters to make no concessions, unless it be strawberries, to stay by water and not venture even to watercress, and certainly not to do so in response to the host's appeal to friendship and love. Would the guest of honor go without touching any of the repast prepared by the host's wife, especially for the guest? Would he not respond at least with a gesture of gratitude and affection? Would he not toy with the plate of watercress arranged by the hand of the absent hostess, for it was a stag party? Surely there was no nourishment here, nothing to break the fast. Affection broke the spell, and the taste of a leaf led to that of another and to another, until in the midst of midnight conversation, the whole plate, meant originally for all of us, was consumed by one guest of honor who had eaten nothing for a week and was not really breaking his fast. But let it be a warning. If you know the virtues of watercress, you need not be told what they do to an empty stomach. And if you do not know, I advise you not to try it. At any rate, the morning found the sociological theosophist so ill and weak that he had to postpone 2 days his departure for the retreat. Even then, he must barely have reestablished his spiritual control of his rebellious physical man. Mr. Aragon's reference to orange juice reminds me of my mother, who once went on an orange juice diet in order to effect a cure of a tumorous condition. When I informed her over the telephone that I had been appointed a fellow in the Center for Advanced Studies, she said, "Why are they always connecting you with the dance?" And then she added, "What university did you say you're going to be in?" I said, "Wesleyan." And she said, being a good Methodist, "Do they know you're a Zen Buddhist?" Well, in Zen they say, in summer perspire, shiver in winter. I might say in the same spirit, when hungry, eat. However, since being here at Wesleyan, I have apparently eaten and drunk excessively. I am now suffering from a gouty arthritic condition. Consider me, please, irrelevant to your abstinent ways. It is abundantly evident that in an academic situation, I am a bad influence. However, following the admonition, give the devil his due, I ask you to listen to two of my stories concerning food. They are part of my lecture, Indeterminacy, New Aspect of Form in Instrumental and Electronic Music. One is about the death of the Buddha, and the other is about the time I myself nearly died. Dorothy Norman invited me to dinner in New York. There was a lady there from Philadelphia who was an authority on Buddhist art. When she found out I was interested in mushrooms, she said, "Have you an explanation of the symbolism involved in the death of the Buddha by his eating a mushroom?" I explained that I'd never been interested in symbolism, that I preferred just taking things as themselves, not as standing for other things. But then a few days later, while rambling in the woods, I got to thinking. I recalled the Indian concept of the relation of life in the seasons. Spring is creation, summer is preservation, fall is destruction, winter is quiescence. Mushrooms grow most vigorously in the fall, the period of destruction, and the function of many of them is to bring about the final decay of rotting material. In fact, as I read somewhere, the world would be an impassable heap of old rubbish were it not for mushrooms and their capacity to get rid of it. So I wrote to the lady in Philadelphia. I said, "The function of mushrooms is to rid the world of old rubbish. The Buddha died a natural death." I will conclude this talk with my second story, for I do not wish to impose too much food for thought on us who have just now filled ourselves, perhaps excessively, though understandably, with actual food. When I first moved to the country, David Tudor, M.C. Richards, the Wine Ribs, and I lived all in the same small farmhouse. In order to get some privacy, I started taking walks in the woods. It was August. I began collecting the mushrooms, which were growing more or less everywhere. Then I bought some books and tried to find out which mushroom was which. Realizing I needed to get to know someone who knew something about mushrooms, I called the 4-H Club in New York City. I spoke to a secretary. She said they'd call me back. They never did. The following spring, after reading about the edibility of skunk cabbage in Metzger's book on wild plants, I gathered a mess of what I took to be skunk cabbage, gave some to my mother and father who were visiting to take home, cooked the rest in water with a pinch of soda, as Metzger advises, and served it to 6 people, one of whom I remember was from the Museum of Modern Art. I ate more than the others did in an attempt to convey my enthusiasm over edible wild plants. After coffee, poker was proposed. I began winning heavily. M.C. Richards left the table. After a while, she came back and whispered in my ear, "Do you feel all right?" I said, "No, I don't. My throat is burning and I can hardly breathe." I told the others to divide my winnings, that I was folding. I went outside and retched. Vomiting with diarrhea continued for about 2 hours. Before I lost my will, I told M.C. Richards to call Mother and Dad and tell them not to eat the skunk cabbage. I asked her how the others were. She said, "They're not as bad off as you are." Later, when friends lifted me off the ground to put a blanket under me, I just said, "Leave me alone." Someone called Dr. Zukor. He prescribed milk and salt. I couldn't take it. He said, "Get him here immediately." They did. Pumped my stomach and gave adrenaline to keep my heart beating. Among other things, he said, 15 minutes more and he would have been dead. I was removed to the Spring Valley Hospital. There, during the night, I was kept supplied with adrenaline and I was thoroughly cleaned out. In the morning, I felt like $1 million. I rang the bell for the nurse to tell her I was ready to go. No one came. I read a notice on the wall that said that unless one left by noon, he would be charged for an extra day. When I saw one of the nurses passing by, I yelled something to the effect, that she should get me out since I had no money for a second day. Shortly, the room was filled with doctors and nurses, and in no time at all, I was hustled out. I called up the 4-H Club and told them what had happened. I emphasized my determination to go on with wild mushrooms. They said, call Mrs. Clark on South Mountain Drive. She said, I can't help you. Call Mr. So-and-so. I called him. He said, I can't help you, but call so-and-so who works in the A&P in Suffern. He knows someone in Ramsey who knows the mushrooms. Eventually, I got the name and telephone number of Guy G. Nearing. When I called him, he said, come over anytime you like. I'm almost always here and I'll name your mushrooms for you. I wrote a letter to Metzger telling him skunk cabbage was poisonous. He never replied. Sometime later, I read about the need to distinguish between skunk cabbage and the poisonous hellebore. They grow at the same time in the same places. Hellebore has pleated leaves. Skunk cabbage does not. Finally, let me say that I have the same high opinion of your singing that I have of your eating. Therefore, I wish all of you, or all of us, for I should like to be included, long happy lives, during the course of which you may recover from any ill effects of this evening's banquet and my after-dinner remarks. We've a bit of time left, so let's continue with Cage's storytelling by playing an excerpt from his Indeterminacy, New Aspect of Form in Instrumental and Electronic Music, as performed by Cage and David Tudor and released on Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. As Stereophile described it, the idea behind Indeterminacy was, like many Cagean ideas, essentially simple and audaciously original. Cage read 90 stories, his speed determined by each story's length. In another room beyond earshot of Cage, David Tudor, pianist and veteran Cage collaborator, performed miscellaneous selections from Cage's Concert for Piano and Orchestra and played pre-recorded tape from Cage's Fontana mix. The resulting collaboration is an astounding piece of music and a fine introduction to the innovations of John Cage, a wonderfully curious way to hear stories. While originally recorded for and released by Smithsonian in the 1950s, the work was later released in a 2-CD box set by the Smithsonian in 1992, the year of Cage's death.
One evening when I was still living at Grand Street and Monroe, Isamu Noguchi came to visit me. There was nothing in the room, no furniture, no paintings. The floor was covered wall to wall with cocoa matting. The windows had no curtains, no drapes. Isamu Noguchi said, an old shoe would look beautiful in this room. You probably know the one about the two monks, but I'll tell it anyway. They were walking along one day when they came to a stream where a young lady was waiting, hoping that someone would help her across. Without hesitating, one of the monks picked her up and carried her across, putting her down safely on the other side. The two monks continued walking along, and after some time, the second one, unable to restrain himself, said to the first, You know we're not allowed to touch women. Why did you carry that woman across the stream? The first monk replied, "Put her down. I did 2 hours ago." Once, when several of us were driving up to Boston, we stopped at a roadside restaurant for lunch. There was a table near a parlor window where we could all look out and see a pond. People were swimming and diving. There were special arrangements for sliding into the water. Inside the restaurant was a jukebox. Somebody put a dime in. I noticed that the music that came out accompanied the swimmers, though they didn't hear it. One day when the windows were open, Christian Wolf played one of his pieces at the piano. Sounds of traffic, boat horns, were heard not only during the silences in the music, but being louder, were more easily heard than the piano sounds themselves. Afterward, someone asked Christian Wolf to play the piece again with the windows closed. Christian Wolf said he'd be glad to, but that it wasn't really necessary, since the sounds of the environment were in no sense an interruption of those of the music. One evening I was walking along Hollywood Boulevard, nothing much to do. I stopped and looked in the window of a stationery shop. A mechanized pen was suspended in space in such a way that as a mechanized roll of paper passed by it, the pen went through the motions of the same penmanship exercises I had learned as a child in the third grade. Centrally placed in the window was an advertisement explaining the mechanical reasons for the perfection of the operation of the suspended mechanical pen. I was fascinated, for everything was going wrong. The pen was tearing the paper to shreds and spattering ink all over the window and on the advertisement, which nevertheless remained legible. It was after I got to Boston that I went into the anechoic chamber at Harvard University. Anybody who knows me knows this story. I am constantly telling it. Anyway, in that silent room, I heard two sounds, one high and one low. Afterward, I asked the engineer in charge why, if the room was so silent, I had heard two sounds. He said, "Describe them." I did. He said, "The high one was your nervous system in operation. The low one was your blood in circulation." Years ago in Chicago, I was asked to accompany two dancers who were providing entertainment at a business women's dance party given in a hall of the YWCA. After the entertainment, the jukebox was turned on so everybody could dance. There was no orchestra, they were saving money. However, the goings-on became very expensive. One of the arms in the jukebox moved the selected record onto the turntable. The playing arm moved to an extraordinarily elevated position. After a slight pause, it came down rapidly and heavily on the record, smashing it. Another arm came into the situation and removed the debris. The first arm moved another selected record onto the turntable. The playing arm moved up again, paused, came down quickly, smashing the record. The debris was removed by the third arm, and so on. And meanwhile, all the flashing colored lights associated with jukeboxes worked perfectly, making the whole scene glamorous. After he finished translating into German the first lecture I gave at Darmstadt last September, Christian Wolff said, "The stories at the end are very good. But they'll probably say you're naive. I do hope you can explode that idea." Down in Greensboro, North Carolina, David Tudor and I gave an interesting program. We played five pieces three times each. They were the Klavierstück 11 by Karlheinz Stockhausen, Christian Wolff's Duo for Pianists, Martin Feldman's Intermission No. 6, Earl Brown's Four Systems, and my Variations. All of these pieces are composed in various ways that have in common indeterminacy of performance. Each performance is unique, as interesting to the composers and performers as to the audience. Everyone, in fact, becomes a listener. I explained all this to the audience before the musical program began. I pointed out that one is accustomed to thinking of a piece of music as an object suitable for understanding and subsequent evaluation, but that here the situation was quite other. These pieces, I said, are not objects, but processes essentially purposeless. Naturally, then, I had to explain the purpose of having something purposeless. I said the sounds were just sounds, and that if they weren't just sounds, I was, of course, using the editorial we would do something about it in the next composition. I said that since the sounds are sounds, this gave people hearing them the chance to be people centered within themselves where they actually are, not off artificially in the distance as they are accustomed to be, trying to figure out what is being said by some artist by means of sounds. Finally, I said that the purpose of this purposeless music would be achieved if people learned to listen, that when they listened, they might discover that they preferred the sounds of everyday life to the ones they were about to hear in the musical program, that was all right as far as I was concerned. However, to come back to my story, a girl in the college there came backstage afterward and told me that something marvelous had happened. I said, "What?" She said, "One of the music majors is thinking for the first time in her life." Then at dinner, it was an afternoon concert, the head of the music department told me that as he was leaving the concert hall, three of his students called, saying, "Come over here." He went over. "What is it?" he said. One of the girls said, "Listen." During that Greensboro concert, David Tudor and I got a little mixed up. He began to play one piece, and I began to play a completely different one. I stopped, since he is the pianist, he is. And I just sat there, listening. When I told David Tudor that this talk on indeterminacy was nothing but a series of stories, he said, "Don't fail to put in some benedictions." I said, "What in heaven's name do you mean by benedictions?" "Blessings," he said. "What blessings?" I said. "God bless you, everyone," Yes, he said. Like they say in the sutras, this is not idle talk, but the highest of truths. There was an American man from Seattle who went to Japan to buy screens. He went to a monastery where he had heard there were very special ones and managed to get an interview with the abbot, who, however, didn't say a word during the entire time they were together. Through an interpreter, the American made known his desires, but received no comment of any kind from the abbot. However, very early the next morning, he received a telephone call from the abbot himself, who turned out to speak perfect English, and who said that the American could not only have the screen he wanted for a certain price, but that furthermore the monastery possessed an old iron gate that he could also purchase. The American said, "But what on earth would I do with an old iron gate? I'm sure you could sell it to a star in Hollywood," the abbot replied. We've now played the winter music quite a number of times. I haven't kept count. When we first played it, the silences seemed very long, and the sounds seemed really separated in space, not obstructing one another. In Stockholm, however, when we played it at the opera, as an interlude in the dance program given by Merce Cunningham and Carolyn Brown early last October, I noticed that it had become melodic. Christian Wolff prophesied this to me years ago. He said, we were walking along 17th Street talking. He said, no matter what we do, it ends by being melodic. As far as I am concerned, this happened to Webern years ago. Karlheinz Stockhausen once told me we were in Copenhagen. I demand one of two things from a composer, invention or that he astonish me. Two monks came to a stream. One was Hindu, the other Zen. The Indian began to cross the stream by walking on the surface of the water. The Japanese became excited and called to him to come back. What's the matter? The Indian said. The Zen monk said, that's not the way to cross the stream. Follow me. He led him to a place where the water was shallow, and they waded across. Another monk was walking along when he came to a lady who was sitting by the path weeping. What's the matter? He said. She said, sobbing, I have lost my only child. He hit her over the head and said, there, that'll give you something to cry about. In New York, when I was setting out to write the orchestral parts of my concert for piano and orchestra, which was performed September 19th, 1958 in Cologne, I visited each player, found out what he could do with his instruments, discovered with him other possibilities, and then subjected all these findings to chance operations, ending up with a part that was quite indeterminate of its performance. After a general rehearsal during which the musicians heard the result of their several actions, some of them, not all, introduced in the actual performance sounds of a nature not found in my notations, characterized for the most part by their intentions, which had become foolish and unprofessional. In Köln, hoping to avoid this unfortunate state of affairs, I worked with each musician individually, and the general rehearsal was silent. I should let you know that the conductor has no score, but has only his own part, so that though he affects the other performers, he does not control them. Well, anyway, the result was, in some cases, just as unprofessional in Köln as in New York. I must find a way to let people be free without their becoming foolish, so that their freedom will make them noble. How will I do this? That is the question. Question or not, that is to say, whether what I will do will answer the situation. My problems have become social rather than musical. Was that what Sri Ramakrishna meant when he said to the disciple who asked him whether he should give up music and follow him? By no means. Remain a musician. Music is a means of rapid transportation to life everlasting. And in a lecture I gave at Illinois, I added, to life, period. People are always saying that the East is the East and the West is the West, and you have to keep from mixing them up. When I first began to study Oriental philosophy, I also worried about whether it was mine to study. I don't worry anymore about that. At Darmstadt, I was talking about the reason back of pulverization and fragmentation, for instance, using syllables instead of words in a vocal text, letters instead of syllables. I said, we take things apart in order that they may become the Buddha. And if that seems too Oriental an idea for you, I said, remember the early Christian Gnostic statement, split the stick, and there is Jesus. Well, since Darmstadt, I've written two pieces, one in the course of a 15-minute TV program in Köln. The other is Music Walk, written during 2 hours in Stockholm. Neither piece uses chance operations. The indeterminacy in the case of Music Walk is such that I cannot predict at all what will happen until it is performed. Chance operations are not necessary when the actions that are made are unknowing. Music Walk consists of 9 sheets of paper having points and 1 without any. A smaller transparent plastic rectangle having 5 widely spaced parallel lines is placed over this in any position, bringing some of the points out of potentiality into activity. The lines are ambiguous, referring to 5 different categories of sound in any order. Additional small plastic squares are provided, having 5 non-parallel lines, which may or may not be used to make further determinations regarding the nature of the sounds to be produced. Playing positions are several, at the keyboard, at the back of the piano, at a radio. One moves at any time from one to another of these positions, changing thereby the reference of the points to the parallel lines. Quangtze points out that a beautiful woman who gives pleasure to men serves only to frighten the fish. When she jumps in the water, once when I was to give a talk at Columbia Teachers College, I asked Joseph Campbell whether I should say something. I forget now what it was I was thinking of saying. He said, "Where is the should?" When I got the letter from Jack Ahrens asking me to again lecture here at the Teachers College, I wrote back and said I'd be glad to, that all he had to do was let me know the date. He did. I then said to David Tudor, "The lecture is so soon that I don't think I'll be able to get all 90 stories written. In which case, now and then, I'll just keep my trap shut." He said, "That'll be a relief." A Chinaman, Kuang Tse tells, went to sleep. And dreamt he was a butterfly. Later, when he awoke, he asked himself, "Am I a butterfly dreaming that I am a man?" An Eskimo lady who couldn't speak or understand a word of English was once offered free transportation to the United States plus $500, providing she would accompany a corpse that was being sent back to America for burial. She accepted. On her arrival, she looked about and noticed that people who went into the railroad station left the city and she never saw them again. Apparently, they traveled someplace else. She also noticed that before leaving, they went to the ticket window, said something to the salesman, and got a ticket. She stood in line, listened carefully to what the person in front of her said to the ticket salesman, repeated what that person said, and then traveled wherever he traveled. In this way, she moved about the country from one city to another. After some time, her money was running out, and she decided to settle down in the next city she came to find employment and to live there the rest of her life. But when she came to this decision, she was in a small town in Wisconsin from which no one that day was traveling. However, in the course of her travels, she had picked up a bit of English. So finally, she went to the ticket window and said to the man there, "Where would you go if you were going?" He named a small town in Ohio where she lives to this day. 4 years ago, I was talking with Hidekazu Yoshida. We were on the train from Donaueschingen to Köln. I mentioned the book by Herigel called Zen in the Art of Archery. The melodramatic climax of this book concerns an archer's hitting the bullseye, though he did so in total darkness. Yoshida told me there was one thing the author failed to point out. That is, there lives in Japan at the present time a highly esteemed archer who has never yet been able to hit the bull's eye, even in broad daylight. The four mists of chaos, the north, the east, the west, and the south, went to visit chaos himself. He treated them all very kindly, and when they were thinking of leaving, they consulted among themselves how they might repay his hospitality. Since they had noticed that he had no holes in his body as they each had eyes, nose, mouth, ears, etc., they decided each day to provide him with an opening. At the end of 7 days, Kuang Tzu tells, chaos died. Now and then, I come across an article on that rock garden in Japan where there's just a space of sand and a few rocks in it. The author, no matter who he is, sets out either to suggest that the position of the rocks in the space follows some geometrical plan productive of the beauty one observes, or not satisfied with mere suggestion, he makes diagrams and detailed analyses. So when I met Ashihara, the Japanese music and dance critic, his first name is Eriyo, I told him that I thought those stones could have been anywhere in that space, that I doubted whether their relationship was a planned one, that the emptiness of the sand was such that it could support stones at any points in it. Ashihara had already given me a present, some table mats, but then he asked me to wait a moment while he went into his hotel. He came out and gave me the tie I am now wearing. After he heard this lecture, which I first gave in Brussels in the French Pavilion, Karl-Heinz Stockhausen said, you should have said, the tie I was wearing yesterday. An old rabbi in Poland, thereabouts, was walking in a thunderstorm from one village to another. His health was poor. He was blind, covered with sores. All the afflictions of Job were his. Stumbling over something, he fell in the mud. Pulling himself up with difficulty, he raised his hands toward heaven and cried out, praise God! The devil is on earth and doing his work beautifully.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.